You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. This is the latest episode in our series on the crisis in Israel and Palestine. My name is Adif Rafiq, and I'm your host. In 1946, President Harry Truman was advised by U.S. diplomats posted in the Middle East not to accede to demands for a partition of Palestine. President Truman told them, "I'm sorry, gentlemen, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who were anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents." Today, President Joe Biden has millions of Arab and Muslim constituents, and amid the war in Gaza, they're making themselves heard. Many in the community are now saying they won't vote for Biden in 2024, in contrast to how they did in large number in 2020. Their votes and non-votes matter. In fact, Arab and Muslim voters could play a pivotal role in swing states like Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And it's Michigan's cities of Detroit and Dearborn where we'll turn our focus today. These areas are home to the largest concentrations of Arabs and Muslims in the United States. They're also politically active. And their congresswoman, the Palestinian-American Rashida Tlaib, is very much at the center of the political uproar following the October 7th attacks by Hamas. In this episode, we're going to take a historical look at how these Arab and Muslim communities in Detroit and Dearborn came to be, and their rise as a force that is not only reshaping the political landscape in Michigan, but could also play a decisive role in choosing the next president. Our guide on this journey will be Sally Howell, a professor of history at the University of Michigan in Dearborn. She's the author of Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past. For more information on her book, click on the link in the show notes. Dr. Howell, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So Arab and Muslim American communities in Detroit and Dearborn are pretty central to the national political debate these days. Their elected representative, Rashida Tlaib, has come under fire for her advocacy on behalf of Palestinians. And the Arab and Muslim communities in these two cities could really play a pivotal role in the 2024 elections because Michigan is a swing state. So I want to begin by helping our listeners understand where this community comes from, because there's a lot of misinformation about them. In the popular media, we hear a lot about no-go zones, and there's just tons of hysteria. But I want to take a deeper look at these communities. So who are the Arabs and Muslims of Detroit and Dearborn, and how deep are their roots in the area?
They're a very diverse community. So they're diverse in terms of where they come from. The early immigrants who came in the late 19th century were from what was then referred to as Greater Syria. So they were mostly from Mount Lebanon and that area, some of them from the Bekaa Valley, some of them from Syria, from Damascus and neighborhoods around Damascus. We also had a few Iraqis who came really early in the 20th century also tending to be Christian, the Chaldean, Roman Catholic Iraqis started coming very early in the 20th century, but in small numbers. Outlying Yemeni migrants came here and worked in the auto industry. Part of that population was Muslim. The Muslims started coming a decade or two after the Christians, but they were definitely here before Henry Ford started his $5 workday, which was in 1914. They already had a settlement in Highland Park, right outside the gates of Ford's Highland Park factory where he sort of invented the modern assembly line. So the Arab community in Metro Detroit has very deep roots. This was the period when the city really grew and became a prominent city nationally, and Arabs were a part of that. And people, many of the workers, Highland Park filled up very quickly. And so Henry Ford was already eyeing Dearborn. He needed more land. He wanted to get away from having the city council of Detroit tell him what to do and tax him and things like that. So he started buying land in Dearborn where he could be right next to the Rouge River, which flows into the Detroit River, so that he could really control his own transportation network and things like that. So he bought land here, built a huge factory here, the Ford River Rouge Assembly. And Arabs came, they helped build that factory They built a neighborhood or participated with immigrants from all parts of the world in creating a neighborhood for themselves right in the shadow of that factory. That's a neighborhood called the South End. So they were here from the beginning. They helped participated in unionizing the Ford Motor Company. They sort of contributed to all the patterns of the 20th century. But in the 1920s, our immigration laws changed and it became very difficult for people to come here from Asia. So this sort of cut off immigration for really more than a generation until the 1960s and 1965, when our laws were liberalized again, and Asian migration in particular picked up. When the doors opened again to people from the Middle East, at that point you had the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, the 73 War, you had a revolution, a civil war in Yemen, and then these were followed by the Lebanese Civil War. Since then, the city, the region has sort of been a receiving zone for Arabs at times of political conflict. The initial people came sort of for economic opportunity, not really so much because of war and conflict, but really in the latter half of the 20th century, it's been just the opposite. And so today in Detroit, the largest population of Arab Americans in the area is Iraqis. So we have a very large Chaldean population, and we also have a lot of refugees who started coming after the first Gulf War and have continued through the second Gulf War, and they're continuing to arrive today. So we have a big Iraqi refugee population. We have a Syrian refugee population that followed that war. And the Yemeni community is growing. They're the fastest growing group of Arab migrants right now in the state, but they're the fastest growing population in Wayne County, which is the county the city of Detroit is in and Dearborn is in.
Mm. Yeah. And so we have a community that's had a presence in this area for well over a century. And as you suggested, this is a community that comes from many different countries, many different regions in the Arab and Arab world and Middle East, and also from different religious backgrounds. And when it comes to the U.S., maybe around half or more of Arab Americans are Christian, while most Muslims in the U.S. and globally are not Arab. So I'd like you to unpack those dynamics in terms of religious demographics of the Arabs of Dearborn and Detroit.
You know, in the early days, in the, let's say, the 1910s and 20s, the first Syrian communities were near the downtown area, sort of on the very, very near east side of Detroit. And they built churches there. And then, you know, they also had communities in Highland Park where that factory was, where Henry Ford's factory was. But the Highland Park, the Muslim community, again, they started coming a little later. And so they didn't have a settlement near the downtown area. They were moving more directly either to Highland Park or Dearborn. So the first mosque that was built in the United States as a mosque opened in Highland Park, just a block away from the gates of Henry Ford's factory, the Muslim Mosque of Highland Park. It opened in 1921. And then eventually when the community moved to Dearborn and got past the worst of the Depression, they opened two mosques in Dearborn. One of them was called Hashmi Hall. That was sort of the Progressive Arabian Hashmi Society. It opened in 1937, and then the second one was the American Muslim Society, which opened in 1938. One was Sunni and the other Shia. So, so the Christian community was diverse, internally diverse, and the Muslim community was as well. And they built institutions to reflect their diversity. The Christians, because they lived on the east side, they sort of migrated to the eastern suburbs and the northern suburbs. And so you can sort of follow their churches over the years, moving from, you know, moving up the economic ladder, basically. Now many of their more prominent churches are up in the northern suburbs, which tend to be wealthier. But the Muslim community, because it was involved in labor more directly, having to do largely with when people arrived in the U.S., and a lot of the Christians had support networks that helped them get into small business, whereas the Muslim population tended to get into labor. So they moved into more working class areas from Highland Park down to Dearborn and the surrounding areas. And so today, Dearborn, with all of its diversity that I mentioned, the Iraqis, the Yemenis, the Lebanese, is the Arab population there is overwhelmingly Muslim, a mix of Shia and Sunni, and lots of different kinds of congregations. So in addition to this national origin and religious diversity, we've got families that are fourth and fifth generation American at this point, and we've got families that are still arriving. So that's the interesting thing about Dearborn is how all of these different Arab Americans, you know, some who have never, you know, don't speak any Arabic at all, and some who don't speak English, you know, how they create a community together and come together and politically, socially, culturally, economically. It's a very dynamic city. So that how long you've been in America, diversity, maybe your political affiliation, types of diversity that we think of more when we're not thinking about Arabs, those are also really viable here.
Yeah, and that was actually going to be my next question. We often hear a lot about questions about assimilation and integration in discussions of Arab and Muslim communities, especially post 9/11. And, you know, some have claimed that these communities are unassimilable, and that discussion is kind of heightened post October 7th. And I think, as you said, this is a dynamic community. And so discussions of assimilation and integration are really complicated by the fact that you have new people coming in here. And so, you know, when we discuss other communities that are seen as having integrated, like the Irish and the Italians, their, you know, levels of mass immigration peaked maybe a century ago. And so we're talking about communities that are kind of static in terms of their composition, and so, at least in terms of their, you know, their broader numbers. The Arabs and Muslims of this area, new people coming in from Iraq, from Yemen, and so their process of reinvention of becoming an American has just commenced for the new arrivals. So talk to us about those dynamics and how it plays out in the community, because, you know, in your book, for example, you had talked about changing religious norms over the 1960s and so in terms of religious orthodoxy and what it meant to be a Muslim and how Islam was practiced. So how does that play out? How has that played out in terms of, you know, the influx of new people and their interaction with old timers?
It's a great question. So as I mentioned before, when the immigration laws changed in the 1920s, the people who moved to Dearborn, I'm going to use Dearborn as my example here, not the whole metro area. I'm just going to zero in on Dearborn. So the Arab Americans who moved to Dearborn were part of this migration of other working class families moving from other parts of the metro area who were also, for the most part, immigrant families. So you had Poles and Lithuanians and Turks and Italians and Maldese and, you know, all these different ethnic communities that lived in the same space. And the parent generation, you know, were immigrants. They maybe English was their second language if they spoke it at all. And then there was a generation of people who were born in the neighborhood or who moved here as children who were American and who grew up with each other. And so they had in common being from this immigrant space. That was the thing that shaped their identity. It wasn't necessarily that the Polish thing was more important or the Arab identity was more important. It was this community had an identity of being an immigrant enclave in a city, the city of Dearborn, that, you know, was, it had sort of an east side, west side, an Anglo-conforming part of town, and then more of an immigrant mix. But the South End was really associated with immigration. And so the people who grew up in that period, again, with immigration cut off, you know, they didn't have new Arabic speakers coming and reinventing their institutions, new restaurateurs arriving. You know, they were kind of doing things for themselves, building mosques, opening, you know, restaurants and grocery stores that catered to their different ethnic communities, participating in the public schools. They were doing this sort of all side by side with these other immigrant groups. And then a lot of the young men went off and fought in World War II together. And that was, of course, a place where we've seen all the Hollywood films where, you know, every squadron had, you know, name your ethnicities were in the group, and they somehow all formed a team by the end of their campaign. And I think that the war did have that effect of making people feel like they were part of a larger American body. So I think it's pretty safe to say that that population was very, very assimilated. And when the new immigration started in Dearborn in the 1960s, the new people who arrived, you know, so whereas in the 20s, you know, many people were foreign born, many people spoke with accents and perhaps dressed in a way that was not the tradition of, you know, other Americans. people could be forgiving of immigrants. But in the 60s, when the new immigrants started coming, Arabs were the only immigrants who were coming to Dearborn, right? And so they stood out. They stood out for their foreignness, and they were coming as war refugees. So they were also poorer than other people in the city and, you know, suffering from the trauma of you know, whatever it was that helped them, that motivated them to migrate, right? And then they also, because of, you know, they were coming sort of under desperate circumstances, they tended to crowd lots of, you know, multiple extended families into one household, which, you know, to the neighbors who at that point were sort of older citizens, looked like it was threatening, you know, it was threatening their property values. Why are those people being so loud next door to us? Why are, you know, that? So it led to some, it was sort of the first period where I think people in the community that I've talked to talk about sort of experiencing discrimination and prejudice was really in the wake of that new migration that started in the 1960s. And it the wonderful thing about Dearborn is that you had this combination, you know, you had the children and the grandchildren of the early immigrants growing up here and becoming politically active. There was a very strong, very left-leaning set of workers in the neighborhood, because again, this is the neighborhood where the UAW, one of the neighborhoods where it really gave birth to the UAW. And so there were some radical workers and radical thinkers in the neighborhood, organic intellectuals, and they were influential here. And so a lot of the young people who grew up here, you know, some of them assimilated to middle class aspirations. They went to law school, they became dentists, you know, that sort of thing. But others of them assimilated more to this radical left politics that was associated with the labor unions and, you know, with you know, sort of an attachment to globalism and looking at colonialism and what was happening and connecting the plight of people in different parts of the world together. So, you know, already, I mean, we're in the 60s and I've already got different threads of assimilation happening, right? And I'm just talking about Dearborn. I'm not talking about the vast metro area where there were all sorts of opportunities for people to assimilate. And so, you know, there's no way that you can argue that Arabs can't assimilate. They very much do when given the chance or when after probably a pretty predictable length of time. But because we've had all this migration from the Middle East that's been happening for the last 50 years, 60 years now, there are also like all sorts of possibilities for assimilation now that where you're assimilating to an Arab community, you know, you're not assimilating to the white working class or the white suburban landscape. Or if you're in a neighborhood in Detroit, to the Black working class or the Black suburban landscape, you know, there are just possibilities here. So you can live in the South End neighborhood today in a neighborhood that's almost entirely Yemeni. And a lot of the people are related to each other. They're from the same villages. And, you know, that's a relatively conservative neighborhood where you see a lot of women wear the niqab. Where people like to be near the mosque, they can walk to the mosque. That's really important to them. Versus a few blocks away or a couple of miles away, where there's another Yemeni neighborhood in the east side, where a lot of women don't wear the hijab at all, and they work outside the home, and they don't want to live next to a mosque. They don't want other Yemenis, you know, telling them how to behave or who to marry or, you know, observing them all the time. So that, you know, it's a really complex community, and there's just infinite possibilities here. I'm famous for saying to my students, there are as many ways to be an Arab American as there are Arab Americans. And I think Dearborn is the place that really, really makes that point.
Yeah, and I think you also made a great point about, you know, the question of assimilation. There are many ways to assimilate because America is ultimately a multi-ethnic, multi-class country. And so if you live in, you know, the suburbs, a very wealthy suburb in the Northeast, assimilation may take on different characteristics than, let's say, if you live in a working class, predominantly Black area in the Midwest. And so the type of attitudes and norms we adopt as one assimilates into ultimately into one's local community is a reflection of dominant behaviors there. And especially in this kind of melting pot that dynamism and the multiple possibilities are put on display quite vividly. So I want to talk about the beginning of political organizing among Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in Detroit and Dearborn. So who are the political pioneers of the Arab American communities in Detroit and Dearborn?
That's a hard to answer, just like everything else, because it's so complicated. I mean, if you go back to World War I, there were organizers here who were trying to organize for a free Syria. And there were alliances here between the Muslim American community in Detroit, the Arab Muslims from Greater Syria, definitely supported independence. They did not want the French or the British to colonize Greater Syria, and they were in fact lobbying that, you know, they wanted independence for Syria, but if independence wasn't possible, they were arguing that they would prefer to have the Americans be the colonial power because they looked to the value system of the American government, which claimed, you know, supported the idea of liberty and justice and self-determination and things like that. And they thought that with American with American being the colonial power there, that they would be able to participate in that liberty, you know, that value system, that it would apply to them, that they would be able to then lobby for their own independence and self-determination. And there were other interest groups here, largely Maronite, who were arguing, of course, for French control of what became Lebanon. So people were organizing then, and actually in the city of Detroit, there was like a mix of other Muslim activists. Some of them were from South Asia and some of them were from Africa, who were working together to sort of create this global Muslim movement that would counteract colonialism in South Asia and Southeast Asia and in Africa and in the Middle East as a collective process, collective project. I would have to say that those are my pioneers, but they clearly did not succeed. But the sentiment there that people had things in common, especially that Islam brought people in contact with one another and created a sense of community among people who were from these different parts of the world. It had a shared legacy of colonialism in one way or another. That has been a thread that has, it's not always a thread that is animated by people, or that, you know, not every generation of Muslim Americans in the area or Arab Americans in the area understands that history. But it has been a repeating theme if you look at the history of the Muslim community here in Detroit. But so to go back to Dearborn itself, the narrative does not begin in 67, but the visibility of the narrative kind of really does pick up after 67, when so many Arabs from here in Dearborn, people were upset in the 1940s after Israeli independence and the way that the Americans kind of quickly got on board with supporting the Zionist project. That repeated itself in 1956, and then it just became so much more visible after 1967, and then especially because we had Palestinians, you know, newly arriving Palestinians making a home for themselves in Dearborn and sort of adding themselves to that mix that had been predominantly Lebanese. So the Palestinian issue became very important then. Can't really say like who would be the one leader who was leading the charge here. There were many people, but there are a couple of campaigns that I think are interesting. So for example, in 1973, there were a group of auto workers who worked in a Detroit factory. It was called the Dodge Main Factory, and it was a factory owned by Chrysler. And this was a period where the auto industry was coming out of the robust years it had had after the Second World War, but it was starting to taper off. And the big three were putting pressure on workers. They were trying to speed up their work on the assembly line, and they were forcing people to work. You know, they didn't give it wasn't, you know, voluntary overtime, it was mandatory overtime. And they were just putting more and more pressure on the workers and squeezing more and more productivity out of them. This factory was one in which there was already a very organized community of Black workers. They called themselves DRUM, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement. And they were a radical organization. They had, you know, intellectuals who were from Wayne State University and a legal team working with them. But it was really the workers who were leading this movement, trying to improve conditions for the Black man in the factory, because they saw that none of the union or very few of their union representatives were Black. And it was sort of like they felt like Black workers were doing the most difficult work, the dirtiest work, were getting the worst treatment from the UAW. And so this group started going on wildcat strikes, which means you're striking without the authorization of the union. And that really makes the workers vulnerable because they can be fired by the union or sanctioned. But they were successful in really calling attention to the plight of Black workers. And the movement was contagious. You had RUM movements, so the Ford Revolutionary Union movement. You know, each local factory had its own chapter of this group. And they were, you know, they were organizing as African-American workers, but they encouraged the white workers around them to also organize chapters so that they could collaborate in lifting up the plight of all the workers. And the one group that really took their call was a group called the Arab Workers Caucus, which was organized largely by Ishmael Ahmed, who is, if you're familiar with Michigan history, you'll know his name. He was a very influential person in the Arab community here. What happened was most of the workers at the time in the factory were these newly arriving people from Yemen and from Palestine. Many of them didn't speak English or didn't have good English, and they were being really abused in the factory, put in the very worst jobs. Some of them were being asked to do the work of two men, and they couldn't complain. They didn't have the ability to complain. I think some of them were worried that they would be deported if they complained, or, you know, they might lose their work visa, and they didn't have the language skills and everything. And so the DRUM leaders definitely saw that there were, there are many quotes of people saying the one person who has it worse than the Black man in the factory is the Arab. And so especially in 1973, and this is because the workers discovered that their UAW union dues were being used to buy Israeli war bonds. And this is in 1973, after the 73 war. And so this was, there's a film about this struggle called Finally Got the News How Your Dues Is Being Used. I think that kind of sums up the feeling that people were very frustrated. And so working together, the Arab Workers Caucus and the DRUM workers organized a wildcat strike to protest the UAW buying the union dues. And it was, you know, they effectively shut down several assembly lines and really caught the attention of the local community, you know, and it created this really important political alliance. Some of the intellectual members of the DRUM movement went on to, they were the editors of a newspaper that came out of Wayne State University, the student newspaper there, which was also called the South End. And they had been publishing, these were radicals again, and they were publishing lots of stories about labor conditions and connecting the plight of African Americans in Detroit to the, you know, unaligned movement in Africa and other parts of the world, and trying to help workers and, you know, subjugated people around the world understand what they have in common. So it was already a very progressive paper, but they started publishing stories about what was happening in Palestine and the, you know, with the new, the then still new occupation. And their stories were devastating and, you know, written very much from a perspective that would be familiar to any Palestinian reader. You know, definitely anti-Zionist coverage of these issues. And that newspaper got shut down by Wayne State University. I mean, just sort of an echo of what's happening today. There are limits to free speech in America if you want to criticize Israel. And I think people found that all the way back in, you know, the late 1960s and the early 1970s here in Detroit. So these solidarities, they have lingered, you know, those specific alliances that were created through the Workers' Caucus, they dissipated. That factory was torn down, actually. And, you know, people went in other directions, but their ties and their connections to each other were maintained over time. And so now we see new new opportunities for people, you know, Black and Brown people in particular. And now in this century, after 9/11 in particular, I think Arab Americans have definitely sort of moved into that category. You know, they sort of moved out of the white category and into the brown one because of their experiences of discrimination. And so those alliances keep recirculating at moments of crisis.
Yeah, and so this looks like kind of like a precursor of the progressive quote unquote intersectional alliances that we see today, reflected at a national level with the Squad, which are, you know, it's a composition of mainly Black and Brown or Arab and Muslim politicians who are serving in Congress. So it very much seems like it foreshadows what we're seeing today. Now, and who are some of the, you know, the initial people in the community who started to run for office? Because we have, you know, this early political activism that is in the early 20th century that is tied to people who have come from, who are essentially part of a colonized diaspora who reside in the U.S. and are in the process of becoming an American, but they're still engaged in activism on behalf of their homelands. And then there is this labor activism that emerges in the 1960s and 70s. So when do we start to see Arab Americans in this area run for office?
So the first person I'm aware of who was an Arab American and a Muslim American who ran for office and won in metro area was actually a man named James Karub. He ran from the city of Highland Park. His father was the imam of that mosque I talked about that was established in Highland Park in 1921. And he also was the imam of the first mosque that opened in Dearborn, the first Sunni mosque that opened here in 1938. And Jim Karub ran for the state legislature and he won. And his father's and his brother's politics were definitely very concerned about Palestine, about Lebanon, about, they were anti-colonial activists on behalf of the Arab world for sure. But it's interesting because when I think about Jim Karub and his politics, he was just such a local politician. He really had the issues. I mean, he's one of the people who introduced legalized gambling to the state of Michigan, and he went on to become sort of the gambling czar of the state of Michigan. So it's like not a trajectory you would perhaps imagine. But in Dearborn, so, I mean, we've had a lot of elected officials, Arab American elected officials. Spencer Abraham was a U.S. senator representing Michigan as a Republican. The Republican Party, he'd been a fundraiser, a strategist for the Republican Party, and sort of his reward was that he was you know, supported for running for the seat in the U.S. Senate, and he won. And I remember I was living in Dearborn at the time. I went to the polls and voted. I lived in East Dearborn. And there was an elderly gentleman in the booth next to me who was voting, and he had his daughter helping him because he could not read the ballot in English. And, you know, he just said, "With the Ibn al-Arab, Ibn al-Arab, when, you know, it's like, I want the son of the Arab, but where's his, get his name, check his name." I think that was the whole point of his going to the polling booth. He was so proud to vote for the son of an Arab. But, you know, Spencer Abraham's politics were very much within the mainstream of the Republican Party. And when he came to Dearborn, he would talk about solidarity with Arabs as Arabs. But I don't know his voting record, but he was no Rashida Tlaib in terms of speaking out on behalf of Arab American causes. And he was not a Muslim American. He was from the Christian part of the community. And there have been many, you know, people who represented Michigan in local elections from the Christian community over time. But for Dearborn, so the community had a little struggle that they faced here, not a little one. It was a big one. It was an existential crisis that they faced in the 1950s and into the 60s when the city of Dearborn tried to rezone the Arab neighborhood, that South End neighborhood, for heavy industry. And they were, you know, guilty of using all these illegal processes and procedures to try and move people out of their homes and demolish their homes and then sell those homes to heavy industry. And so the industry was sort of encroaching on the neighborhood. The neighborhood was shrinking. And, you know, this was, again, in the 50s and 60s. And so if you were Polish, you know, there were Polish churches in other parts of town. There were Polish social clubs. There were restaurants and other places that you could go to. But especially by the 1960s, you know, the Arab community in Dearborn had a presence here. It had a business infrastructure. It had a social infrastructure, and it had these mosques. And they didn't have that infrastructure anywhere else. They really had it in Dearborn. And so while the people who started to resist the city's effort to rezone their neighborhood, it started off as a multi-ethnic coalition. Really, in the end, it wound up being the Arabs who stayed and actually really fought City Hall. And so a lot of the early people that we saw running for office in the city of Dearborn were people who grew out of that movement. So the first person who ran for the city council from the Arab American community was a woman named Helen Atwell. Her maiden name was Okti. She married a non-Arab. That's why she had such an Anglo-sounding last name. But she was a very proud daughter of the neighborhood and a very active participant in the mosque. She was initially in her earlier life, she was a housewife, and people talk about all the meetings that took place at her kitchen table. You know, she had 8 children, and so she would feed her children and she would feed all the activists too. And so she ran for city council in the 1970s and was firmly rejected at the polls. She did very badly. I think that she was shocked by how badly she did. And she felt that the mayor really sort of drummed up racist, anti-Arab sentiment to keep her out of office, because she was a radical and she was sort of a thorn in the side of the city, along with many other activists. So when the Arab community started growing in Dearborn again, the city had no infrastructure anymore for receiving immigrants. It hadn't, you know, the public schools weren't good they didn't have good bilingual programs. And, you know, there was a lot of prejudice, and people in the Arab community wanted to have the opportunity to represent themselves to others in the city, to challenge stereotypes or to explain the social needs of this new community. And as a result, sort of this alliance was created between Arab Americans, the second and third generation people, and the newly arriving people. And they created an organization called ACCESS, the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, which was really just sort of an all-around service organization. In the beginning, it was like translations, English classes, helping people pay their bills. And then they graduated into being a really full service organization. Today, they're in addition to being the largest Arab service organization in the country, one of their side products is the Arab American National Museum. They also have a Center for Arab American Philanthropy. I mean, they're just doing amazing work in all these zones. But so a lot of the people who wound up running for office grew out of that alliance, that effort to fight City Hall on behalf of the neighborhood. By the way, they won. The neighbors won. So they were able to protect their neighborhood in the end. And that's why the South End is still it's sort of the anchor neighborhood for the Arab population here in Dearborn. So the first person to successfully run for office in Dearborn, or for city council anyway, was a woman named Suzanne Serrani, who was ironically a Republican. She was a part of the creation of ACCESS. She was there at the beginning helping provide rights and opportunities for the newly arrived immigrants. But her father was a restaurant owner on Dix Avenue, the sort of business street in the middle of the neighborhood. And so she sort of followed her father into a more traditional Republican identity. But and I think that's part of why she was able to win. She also, her husband was Lebanese, but her last name was Serrani, which in a city like Dearborn sounds pretty Italian. Anyway, so she ran for office, and she first was elected to the city council in 1990. And to me, that's really late in the day for a community that had been here really since the city incorporated and became, you know, this conglomeration that we refer to as Dearborn. Arabs had been a part of that narrative. So it's just the fact that she was the first to be elected, and then it was another 20 years before a second person was elected to the city council. This tells me that there was very strong anti-Arab sentiments that just kept growing throughout the 60s and the 70s and into the 80s. So the community was growing, and they were demanding more respect from the city, demanding more resources, more opportunity. So that was happening. But at the same time, you had this demonization of Arabs and especially of Muslims that was taking place in the media following each of these wars we've talked about. And so the national sentiment was definitely turning anti-Arab, and that was really sort of exacerbated here at the local level by local political dynamics, especially over things like housing. If you look at the history of the Detroit area, the racial discrimination in housing is one of the definitive narratives of Detroit history, and the Arab community definitely has faced their own version of that.
Yeah, and so it's notable that some of the early folks who ran for office were, one, women, and two, they were driven by local politics. And as Tip O'Neill famously said, all politics is local. And so I think, you know, these political trends in the 1970s and 80s in the community contradict many of the tropes that have been, that are directed at Arab and Muslim communities in the U.S. as well as in the West, that they're focused on some transnational agenda, and that these are misogynistic communities where women don't play a role and all that. So the political emergence of this community, at least in a formal electoral politics fashion, really defies those tropes. Now, I want to talk about the period of the 1980s and the 1990s, because during that period, we saw, at least at a national level, Arab American organizations try to emulate many of other established communities and develop a political machine at a national level to drive political influence. And so we saw the Arab American Institute endorse Jesse Jackson in 1984. Jesse Jackson formed the Rainbow Coalition, which was very much a precursor of the kind of diverse political coalitions that we see today in the Democratic Party. And then in 1988, they ultimately endorsed Michael Dukakis, who rejected their endorsement because the community was seen as toxic. And so how did that play at a local level? I'm wondering how those dynamics in terms of at the national level search for political coalitions within the Democratic Party, and then the rejection by the mainstream Democratic Party, the sort of centrist element, how did that play out at a local level?
So there are a couple of ways. So first, I did neglect to mention another person who ran for public office in Michigan who succeeded in the 1970s. I have to look up the year he first ran. He might have actually won office in the 1960s. This is a lawyer who grew up in the South End neighborhood and came out of the community. His name was Michael Berry, and he was a very active in the Democratic Party at the local level here in Dearborn and at the county level. And he was elected road commissioner for Wayne County, which is, again, the county of Dearborn and Detroit, and with along with many other communities. And this is before, in the state of Michigan, we had a position like county executive. So in effect, the road commissioner was the one who managed a big portion of the budget of the county. The international terminal of the Detroit airport, until a few years ago when they redesigned the airport and opened some new terminals, was named the Michael Berry Terminal. And I always thought that was interesting because his real name was Muhammad Berry. So I always liked the fact that our international terminal was named after a Muslim named Muhammad, even if it said Michael Berry. Some of us actually knew. And when you know, George Bush came to Detroit after 9/11, he arrived in that terminal. And the airfield was actually managed by another Arab American Muslim at the time. So when people were so paranoid about Arabs, you know, Arabs were running the airport basically. But so Michael Berry was really important in the Democratic Party, but he was not a part of that left that I talked about, having come out of the South End neighborhood. So there was the more radical left, and so some of the there was a little bit of tension here in the Arab community over how to participate in party politics. And Suzanne Tereni and some business people created a chamber, they participated in the Dearborn Chamber of Commerce, but they also created an Arab American Chamber of Commerce and, went on to sort of court Republican inclusion in the Republican Party. But the people who are further to the left in Dearborn, they worked very closely with Jim Zogby in the 80s and the period you're describing. And the Arab American Institute was very active here in Dearborn in terms of bringing their Yalla Vote campaign here and doing voter registration. There were so many activists on the ground here in Dearborn who just, you know, I feel like the only conversation I ever had with them was about voter registration. They were really eager. And one of the main issues for them in terms of registering people to vote was to provide better school services for the Arab community, because so many of the resources in Dearborn were being spent in the western, wealthier part of town, whereas the population that was most in need and the population that was growing was in East Dearborn, where the Arabs were. So there was just this long struggle over providing resources to the schools, providing park resources, providing, you know, any sort of institutional, infrastructural resources to the part of the town that the Arabs were in because the city was consistently ignoring that part of town. And even in the 1980s, we had a man who ran for city council. He ran for mayor. He had been the head of the city council for a few years. His name was Michael Guido. And when he ran for mayor, he ran sort of on two campaign issues. One was an anti-Black campaign that he had, which was, you know, what to do about the parks in the city of Dearborn, because the city of Dearborn had put in place a resolution that said only city residents could use city parks. Okay. So Dearborn was a population that had a history of segregationism. We had a longstanding mayor here, Orval Hubbard, who was the sort of most famous or infamous segregationist mayor of the North. And so the city had remained very, very white, like less than 3% minority all the way through the 1980s. You know, and this is a city that, you know, the largest border that the city has is with the city of Detroit. It's like a kidney almost in the side of Detroit. So it's surrounded on three sides by the city of Detroit, which was in the 60s and 70s, 80s, was flipping demographically from being a white majority city to a Black majority city. So the fact that Dearborn could remain so segregated in an era when the other suburbs were integrating, and where the city of Detroit was actually, you know, becoming more segregated, but becoming Blacker. It's just amazing. And so this issue of, if you say only a Dearborn resident can use a Dearborn park, then you're, you know, if I'm a white person, if I went into the park, no one would challenge whether I was a Dearborn resident or not. But if you were an African-American and you came into the park, you would be carded and asked to leave. So this was one of the big political issues. And the NAACP and other activists in Detroit boycotted Dearborn businesses. There was a legal case, and the courts ruled that this was discriminatory and illegal on the surface. And so the city had to cancel this project. And so Guido was claiming he was going to find a new solution for this problem, which was really just a segregationist issue. And then the second thing he ran on was the Arab problem. So he actually had campaign literature that said what to do about the city parks and the Arab problem. And, you know, he had, to, you know, he was basically, you know, race baiting white voters and telling them that he would protect their city against both Blacks and Arabs. And he won also, he won by significant majority. And I think that really freaked out the Arab community and drove them even further to the left, you know, because they found allies on the left. And so Jim Zogby was definitely the idea of voting and the significance of voting here in Dearborn really mattered. And people in the Arab community knew it. If they wanted to get power at the local level, they needed to vote. And if they wanted to change American foreign policy in the Middle East, they needed to vote. So it was really another sort of existential problem for the community. And I remember when Jesse Jackson ran for office, this was probably one of my first years here in Detroit. And I was at his rally that he had at the UAW Local 600 in the South End neighborhood. He came to Access and spoke to people at Access. The Arab community really came out and supported him. He actually won the city of Dearborn in the Democratic primary. Jesse Jackson won the Democratic primary in Dearborn, which, you know, given the city's segregationist history, was remarkable. And most people who were observing this at the time basically attributed this to the success of the Arab vote, that, you know, the left working class population of the city would not have brought him enough votes to actually win the primary there. without the Arab community. So I think this gave people like Jim Zogby in Washington, and it gave Ish Ahmed here in Dearborn and other political activists, Mike Berry. It sort of compelled Michael Berry to work with the people who were further to his left, and they sort of created a more powerful alliance here within the Democratic Party. And people have been playing Democratic Party politics here in Dearborn ever since, like really making sure you have the delegates and, you know, doing our homework, trying to influence the state platform locally within the city. It's all local issues. And at the state level, it's very much a mix of, you know, employment, economy, you know, the roads, all of these issues. But at the state level, people are usually trying to get a voice on issues pertaining to the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East.
And actually, right now, I'm looking at a picture of Jesse Jackson addressing the Palestine Aid Society convention in 1984 in Detroit. So, you know, it's a reflection of how he was able to go into unchartered, maybe transgressive territory, at least politically speaking, given the fact that, you know, any kind of association with the cause of Palestine was really politically toxic in the U.S., at least in terms of electoral politics. Now, you know, you talked about how the community really became entrenched in sort of the Democratic Party, at least at a local level. But in the early 2000s, in the 2000 election, in fact, we saw, at least at a national level, Arab Americans and Muslim Americans tilt right. And that was the first tilt right, perhaps. Major Arab American Muslim organizations endorsed George W. Bush. He appointed, for example, Spencer Abraham as energy secretary. You know, he's Lebanese American. And Bush had used the term Judeo-Christian Islamic in his election speeches to kind of integrate Muslims into the political fabric. And then came 9/11, and that changed everything. So I'd like you to talk about how that disruption caused by 9/11 at a local level and how it shook the community's social and political fabric.
Yes. Well, so, I mean, I think any immigrant community is susceptible to Republican politics because the Republicans tend to play the social, moral, you know, the values issues that appeal to immigrant communities wherever they're from, and also the economic interests they claim to represent, the, you know, the small businessman and to provide support for, you know, for small business owners, which the Arab community and the Muslim community both have many, many small business owners. And so those the perception of Republican politics in terms of supporting pocketbook issues also draws people to that side. And but Bush really did. You're right. He appealed to Muslim voters in a way that no one had done before. And he even said in one of the debates that he would look into the issue or try and put a halt to interrogation of the kinds of special targeting by the surveillance state and interrogations of Arab Americans that had really kind of become more common after the first Gulf War or in the lead up to the first Gulf War. And so that was one of the issues that he championed that was very important to the Arab community and the Muslim community. So it was, you know, it was the after effects of the 9/11 attacks and the rapid, you know, launch of the invasion of Afghanistan and the, you know, the extreme anti-Muslim rhetoric that followed all of these things. I mean, it was a very fearful time here in Dearborn and at the local level. And, you know, you saw a lot of people definitely pulling back their support for Republicans. And, you know, George Bush's name became, you know, it became a bad word here in Dearborn and Detroit. And, you know, really focused on those issues of the ways in which the community was being targeted by the FBI and treated like John Ashcroft, as though, you know, there were very quickly after 9/11, like within days of the attacks, there was a raid on a house in Detroit, right very near or just on the outskirts of Dearborn or just across the border with Dearborn, that had four Arab men living in it, one of them who worked at the airport and therefore had airport, you know, like security materials there that he had been studying up on. And, you know, these men, they referred to the house as a Detroit sleeper cell for Al-Qaeda. And, you know, there were so many news stories about this house. And, you know, it just seemed like every time the Arab community in Detroit was in the national news, it was there was some accusation of support for terrorism here, terrorists hiding here. And of course, you know, the terror cell was proven to be a, you know, an overreach by the U.S. attorney here in Detroit at the time. And these none of these men were prosecuted for terrorism. And, you know, so many of the other cases also fell through. So the community definitely felt under siege and felt that the Republican Party was, you know, had really hardened in opposition to them. Yeah, people kept trying to get closer to the Democratic Party, but there still wasn't a lot of of embrace of the community. I mean, a lot of Arab Americans supported Ralph Nader when he ran for president, and specifically because he was an Arab. And it was not just because he was an Arab, he was definitely a member of the left, but he also eventually came out with a very pro-Palestinian statement as a part of his campaign platform. I think that made it a lot easier for young people in the Arab American community to support him. So and this is the point at which we see this bifurcation in Democratic politics here in the Dearborn area between sort of an older generation of people who had tried to play by the rules, you know, who had tried to support whoever was the nominee of the party, who had gone to the state platform, you know, conventions and tried to influence the state party platforms and had gone to Washington and done the same thing at the Washington level, the sort of the AAI kind of political engagement with this younger generation of people who were, you know, not willing to play that game anymore and wanted more sort of really to go back to that idea of self-determination for Arab Americans in terms of their political voice. And so the I think in the last 20 years, we've seen that when Obama ran for office, you know, he was so afraid of having been raised a Muslim. And, you know, people were saying he was, you know, he was in fact a Muslim and the whole association with his father. He was just really not welcoming or friendly to Muslims, especially in his first campaign. And it was here in Detroit that, you know, a group of young people managed to, you know, show up early and they were invited to sit behind him at the podium of one of his rallies here in Detroit. And one of the women who wears a hijab. And so she was asked to leave. They were asked to leave. They didn't want a picture of a candidate, Obama, you know, standing in front of and being cheered on by a Muslim, a visible, obvious Muslim in the background. So, you know, there were just, you know, just generations of you get close to people. The campaigns might have Muslim outreach coordinators. They might have Arab American outreach coordinators who are working in the community. But over and over again, I think people just kept getting sort of slapped by the Democratic Party.
So we have a clear difference in terms of, you know, generationally, we have what one might call the post 9/11 generation of politicians that are emerging. So we have, you know, Rashida Tlaib, Abdulrahman al-Sayed, and now Dearborn has an Arab Muslim mayor, Abdullah Hamoud. So as, you know, as a historian who teaches in the city, you've already touched upon this a bit, but talk to us about the differences in terms of what this generation expects in terms of their own political representation as compared to their elders.
It's very much of a different ballgame. There has been a huge generational shift that we've seen over the last 20 years. And it's honestly remarkable. I remember I really became aware of it in 2016 when Bernie Sanders was running against Hillary Clinton. I could understand that there was no enthusiasm in Dearborn for Hillary, but I really didn't understand the appeal of Bernie. I was really caught by surprise by that. And it was mostly young Arab Americans, and they were interested in Bernie Sanders' whole platform. They wanted more money for the schools. They wanted money to be, you know, they didn't want money to be sent overseas to fight foreign wars. You know, they wanted a real investment in American infrastructure. And they, you know, I think he was talking about changing the conversation about race in America and trying to create more equality. You know, the income gap between wealthy and lower income people was just widening and widening and widening. And he was taking on that issue. And so people supported him on all these issues, but I still didn't quite believe it. But, you know, Bernie Sanders won Dearborn. He beat Hillary Clinton here in the primary in Dearborn. And this is very similar to what had happened with Jesse Jackson, right? It was the Arab community who came out and supported Bernie. And I don't think that Bernie started off sounding, I mean, he welcomed the Arab community. He welcomed the Muslim community. He talked about non-discrimination. He talked about the excesses of the war on terror and how that had affected the Arab community. But he didn't really talk about Palestine until he came to Dearborn and met with some community activists here in Dearborn who had championed him. And they convinced him to come up with a campaign strategy or a platform that was, it was not, you know, exactly what Arab Americans might ask for. He was changed by his relation with this, by his relationship with Arab activists in this community. And the same thing happened in 2020. He again won in Dearborn. But so this younger generation, they're committed to a different kind of politics. They want to fight capitalism. They want to fight globalism, not from the position of the right, but from the position of the left. They want their communities to work. They're definitely support the Green Revolution, and they're thinking about their long-term futures and the futures of their family here in America. And they want to make, they're tired of the old politics of the Democratic Party. So, and that's these are the people who have been elected to office in this area for the most part. So the city of Hamtramck and a big swath of Detroit elected a Yemeni American, a young Yemeni American progressive named Abraham Ayash he's in the House, and he's the Speaker of the House here in Michigan, which is remarkable. And this is because of his long activism, like anti-racism activism and environmental justice activism on behalf of residents of Hamtramck in Detroit. We, of course, Rashida Tlaib, quite famously won her district in Detroit, which was not an Arab American district at all. It was a majority African American district. Her initial district was mostly in Detroit and then in some of the downriver white working class suburbs, who, again, you would traditionally think would not vote for an Arab woman. But this is because of her long history in the state when she was in the state legislature, of fighting for the rights of her constituents and, you know, all this anti-racism work she's done over the years. And she's also an environmental justice activist. And she, of course, was one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. She and Ilhan Omar. And, you know, they have just drawn so much negative attention by being Muslim, by standing up for Palestinian rights since their first day on the job. But they're, as you pointed out, they're part of this coalition of left activists, mostly women of color, actually, but quite a few men in there, too, and not all Black and brown people, but definitely representing, of the far left position in Congress. And Rashida is the first Palestinian woman to be elected to Congress as well. And she has, in this current crisis we're going through, she has become the voice, really, of the Palestinian community in America. The kind of censure she received has been shocking for people and upsetting for people. And after the attack of October 7, the Hamas attack in Israel, I think the left progressive people in the state of Michigan have been making such a difference. We had Abdel-Sayed, who ran for governor and did very well in the Democratic primary. He probably was a thorn in the side of the governor, Governor Whitmer, who won, and he did not get hoping he would get some sort of statewide appointment. That did not follow because he ran a pretty hard campaign and proved that he actually challenged her. But, I mean, her administration has been amazing. They have appointed so many Arab Americans and Muslim Americans and all from that younger generation, the new generation of activists. It used to be that the Arab population here in Dearborn, you know, kind of was complacent in its middle, in its working class background. And a lot of, second generation, the children of immigrants from the Lebanese Civil War, they might want to go into business. They saw their fathers be entrepreneurs and succeed. So this entrepreneurial impulse has been very strong in Dearborn. A lot of students from Dearborn, you know, were hesitant to go to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and live in a dorm and be away from home, they would come to my campus, the University of Michigan Dearborn, which is in the city of Dearborn. It's a commuter campus. But in the 90s, and, you know, I guess more increasingly in this century, people have started going to Ann Arbor. There are a lot of scholarships now that are available to people in Ann Arbor, so making it more affordable. And people have just started going there, and they're being trained in a more political way than we were doing on this campus. It's clear if you look at the mayor of Dearborn, his entire administration has some relationship either to the University of Michigan or Ann Arbor or to Harvard. These are very well educated people. This push for education and for a kind of like middle class success, no longer working class success or independent entrepreneurial success, but people are becoming engineers and political strategists and getting degrees in social work and environmental activism and things like this.
Yeah. So it looks like this new generation of Arab American activists and politicians have far greater expectations in terms of representation, and they're also unafraid to show their identity or their heritage. So that's a marked difference, I think, from previous generations of Arab American public officials. And then also, it's really interesting that this community, and I think that it reflects national patterns as well, this community, which is heavily Arab American and Muslim, was avidly supportive of Bernie Sanders, who could have been America's first Jewish president. You know, there's plenty of examples of the ugliness of politics, but that is kind of the beauty of politics in terms of its ability to create these cross-cutting alliances where people transcend boundaries that maybe have existed for quite some time, but because of shared values and shared experiences, they become one, at least in terms of who they select on the ballot. So there's the good and the bad, and then there's the ugly. And right now we see a lot of that ugly at the national level with the attacks on Rashida Tlaib and the outright bigoted vitriol that leveled at Arab Americans and this talk of Gaza refugees that's coming from the right. So there's a high degree of hysteria and bigotry that's being directed at Arab Americans. But at the same time, the Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, and Muslim Americans are very unhappy with President Biden's support for Israel after the October 7th attacks. And many are saying that, at least anecdotally, I'm hearing that many are saying that they may not necessarily vote for Trump, but they could leave the presidential part of the ballot blank. And this is the final question. What is your sense of the mood on the ground right now in terms of how the community is responding to this post-October 7th scenario? And what does it mean for 2024?
The community has been shocked by Biden's just one-sided approach, just unabashed support for Israel. No ceasefire has yet been called by him. You know, the governor here in Michigan issued a statement. The president of the University of Michigan issued a statement. Debbie Dingell, the former congresswoman who represented Dearborn, issued statements that didn't mention Palestinians at all. That offered full throated support for Israel, mourning for Israel, referring to Hamas as a terrorist organization, and not mentioning Palestinian suffering, the loss of life of Palestinians, not mentioning Palestinian humanity at all. And this governor is someone, the Arab community, they went from supporting Abdel Sayed directly to supporting her and her candidacy. They were in her camp. She won Dearborn by a large majority. Debbie Dingell, despite the fact that people had longstanding reservations over her foreign policy positions, she also won Dearborn by a large majority, including all of the Arab precincts, quite specifically the Arab parts of town. And as I said, you know, Whitmer had been really open to the Arab community and the Muslim community, having iftars in her house, and you know, bringing these people into politics, working really closely with the Commission for Middle Eastern American Affairs that we have at the state level, instead of it treating it like it was a, you know, an afterthought, treating it was like an important body, and placing Arab Americans in influential positions in the state, sort of every decision that has to do with the future of the state of Michigan, recognizing in particular that the population is shrinking here in the state and we need it to grow. And the part of the population that's growing is the Muslim American part of it. And so trying to empower that group and leverage that group to bring more people here. So this is what was happening before October 7, but now it's just the opposite. The governor, a few weeks ago, she was supposed to come to a fundraising banquet here in Dearborn for a Muslim organization, a great Muslim charity in Dearborn. But the social media, you know, voice basically spoke up and said, this woman is not coming to our, if she comes to Dearborn, we are going to picket that event. But she's not going to be able to get inside. I mean, they were threatening a sort of a very, very active picket and demonstration and even sort of civil action. So she bowed out of the event and didn't come. And it's like this for Joe Biden as well. I mean, people feel abandoned. They feel betrayed. They feel, you know, look, we've been playing by the rules. We've been doing this for so many generations now. But in particular, in this century, we were at the table. We deserved our seat at the table. We want our voices to be heard. Why are we being discriminated against in this way? Why is this, you know, in the university climate right now, the question is, you know, if people put a Palestinian flag up on a bulletin board, other students are claiming that this is anti-Semitism. You know, if a display of a flag is anti-Semitism, it makes it very hard. You can see how that goes to affect the censure of Representative Tlaib. I mean, there's people feel like not only have their past votes, their past loyalty to the party not been recognized or represented, but like their very existence is being threatened. If you can't speak your mind, if you can't voice support in this moment of just straight up genocidal violence, you know, if people can't recognize the humanity of your family and your community overseas, how that means that they don't recognize yours. So this is a form of erasure. It's very painful for the community. The silence of the elected officials in the Democratic Party about the loss of Palestinian life, this silence is a form of violence in itself. That's how the leaders of the Arab community of Dearborn today are taking this situation. Absolutely, they're saying that they are not going to vote for Joe Biden. And as you know, he won the state of Michigan by 150,000 votes, 155,000 votes. There are 200,000 Muslim American voters in Michigan. And they this is a swing state. They absolutely have the ability to swing this election. Now, I have also talked to some of the older generation of Arab Americans who get very frustrated when they hear the younger generation of elected officials in the city say, we are not going to vote for Joe Biden. We are going to go to the polls, just as you suggested, and we're going to show that we're voters. We're going to show that we have power. We're going to make a difference on the local level, but we are not going to support any candidate who did not stand up on behalf of Palestinians in this moment of, you know, horrific warfare. But I do think that I don't know what is going to happen. I don't know where this vote will go. I don't think that there's a way for Joe Biden to work his way back into the graces of the Arab American population here in Michigan. I really don't. But I don't know what happens to their vote otherwise. And as we see, that nationally, Americans think that the nationally Americans support a ceasefire. I think the percentages are over 60% now of American voters who actually support a ceasefire. There's some major disconnect between the media and the way they're representing this crisis and where American voters are. And this is also an issue of generational change, right? After the after 9/11, after the Women's March, all these coalitions, the Black Lives Matter campaign, when lots of Arab Americans stood up on behalf of Black lives, lots of African Americans are standing up now on behalf of Arab lives. So there's there is a generational shift happening. But I am a historian. I am not a prognosticator. I can't predict where it will go because I've also seen generation after generation of elected officials sort of embracing the Arab community, but then at moments of crisis like this one, abandoning them. And that's what's happening now. This generation of voters, from what I've seen here in Michigan, they're saying that they're not going to play ball.
And that was Sally Howell of the University of Michigan in Dearborn. We'll be back the week after Thanksgiving with a new episode. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. And thank you for tuning in.